Okay, welcome everyone. Welcome back to the Strong Gravity Seminar Series. We're fortunate to have Christoph Kiel with us today. He just received his PhD earlier this year at the University of Cambridge and has now moved on as a postdoc to the ETH Zurich. Yeah, welcome, Christoph, and we're looking forward to your talk. So please take it from here.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Daniel, for this nice introduction. And it's obviously, as I told you before, a pleasure and a great honor to speak here at the Perimeter Institute. And I'm talking about the Diophantine approximation as the cosmic sensor for ADS black holes. And kind of this, my talk is going to be a problem and the question of determinism within general relativity, and particularly in the context of ADS black holes. And as it will turn out, this will be related and intimately tied to Diophantine approximation. So please interrupt me at any time. And let's get started. So just to remind ourselves, general relativity is a dynamic theory, and the mathematical manifestation, or the manifestation of that fact, is that the Einstein equations, they're hyperbolic, and they admit the well-posed initial value formulation. Just also a brief reminder, in vacuum, the Einstein equations are, of course, Ricci equals lambda g, and depending on the context, lambda can be either zero, positive, or negative, depending on what kind of one studies. I will be, in this talk, I will be focusing on the asymptotically ADS black holes, so here lambda is negative. So as I said already, GR is a dynamic theory, obviously. So we always think of the space times, the solution of the Einstein equation, as arising from appropriate initial data. And this well-posedness of the Einstein equations as a hyperbolic problem finds a manifestation in the famous theorem due to Choquet-Bruhat, which we have depicted here, which says that for appropriate initial data, so in some sense three-dimensional space, there exists a unique maximal future development, which is in four-dimensional space-time, solving the Einstein equation. And kind of with this theorem in mind, everything in the talk, we should always keep this theorem in mind as Einstein equation as an initial value problem. Okay, so as already said, I will address a question about determinism in the strong cosmic censorship conjecture. But before we talk about determinism within general relativity, I will first kind of give an analog or introduce you what I mean by determinism in in Newtonian gravity. So for Newtonian gravity, let's first think of n point masses, which are located at position xi. And Newton tells us that they have to obey kind of this system of ODEs, which I have. Let's see if this works. Oh no, this doesn't work. Okay, let's see. Okay, here it works. Now it works. Okay, which have to obey this system of ODEs. And so again, this is a initial value problem. So we give initial values for xi. And then kind of Newtonian gravity is indeed deterministic because one of the following two scenario appears or occur. Then we first either the solutions of this system of ODEs live forever, meaning that the solutions exist globally, or we exit the validity of the theory. And this occurs if the forces between two particles become infinite and the particles become infinitely close. So again, either a solution exists forever, or if not, then this is the reason the theory stops, is that the solution only exists for finite time is that we leave the validity of the theory. So now back to Einstein, keeping what we have learned from Newton gravity in mind. So to answer this question, let's look first at explicit solutions of the Einstein equations. And so for for lambda equal to zero, but in some sense the same, or the analogous solutions and the analogous statements hold true for solutions for lambda positive and lambda negative. So let's look at the Minkowski space then first, then the non-rotating Schwarzschild black hole, and finally the Kerr black hole, and see kind of whether they are deterministic, just like Newton gravity is, Newtonian gravity is. Okay, so the Minkowski space-time, again, we think of the unique evolution of trivial initial data, namely, okay, R3 with the Euclidean metric gives rise in view of Choquet-Bruhat's theorem to the Minkowski space-time, which I have written here explicitly. And Minkowski can be depicted in a so-called Penrose diagram, which is a two-dimensional illustration of this four-dimensional space, by kind of quotient out by the spheres. So every point in this Penrose diagram up to this r equals zero line, but every point in this Penrose diagram is a two-dimensional sphere. If you don't know what it is, it doesn't matter, but the kind of one nice thing about this is that radial light rays, they move along 45 degrees in this Penrose diagram. So we can read off causality. So now, Minkowski space-time is geodesically complete. So we have global existence and uniqueness. And observers live forever. But not only Minkowski space-time, this kind of explicit solution, but also if we start with small perturbations of the trivial initial data, then this will also lead to a solution, again, in view of Choquet-Bruhat's theorem, which will be global. So in particular, we have global existence and uniqueness for small perturbations of Minkowski space-time. And this is a theorem due to Christodoulou Kleinemann, and it is proved in 1993, and the stability of Minkowski space. So in that sense, determinism holds true for Minkowski and small perturbations of their initial data. We have global existence and uniqueness just in the case of the first scenario, kind of if you compare to Newton gravity, Newtonian gravity. Okay, so now let's move on to the Schwarzschild black hole. So the Schwarzschild black hole is a static non-rotating black hole parameterized by mass, as you very well know, and the metric I've given also, just to remind ourselves. And again, here I have depicted it in a Penrose diagram, and kind of the geometric features of it, that it's geodesically incomplete. So if an observer gamma is so courageous, let's say, as to enter the black hole region, which is here in the middle, then this observer gamma reaches this strong singularity r equals zero in finite proper time. So particularly this space-time is not global, and it's geodesically incomplete. And this singularity at r equals zero is so strong that this observer gamma is truly torn apart by infinite tidal deformations. And the geometric manifestation of this fact is that Schwarzschild is inextendable even as a continuous space-time. And here maybe I should point out that in some sense it's trivial to see by computing the Kretschmann scalar that Schwarzschild is inextendable as a C2 metric, because the Kretschmann scale is a curvature component, which is on the level of two derivatives of the metric. But it's proven by Spiersky that indeed Schwarzschild is inextendable as a continuous space-time, and that corresponds to the fact that gamma is torn apart by infinite tidal deformation if gamma reaches the singularity. So in particular, here also determinism holds true because, okay, we are not geodesically incomplete. We are not geodesically complete. We are incomplete. But the incompletely is truly a feature of the fact that at that point, the validity of the theory breaks down because, in some sense, there are infinite tidal deformations. So an observer is truly destroyed, and one has to incorporate other theories. Okay, so now, however, let's go to the Kerr black hole. So that's a rotating black hole. It's a generalization of the Schwarzschild black hole with angular momentum. And for non-zero angular momentum, I should have to say, I should have said here, the Penrose diagram looks as depicted. And the point is that just like Schwarzschild, also occur as a black hole region, and also occurs incomplete. In particular, an observer who is again courageous as to enter the black hole will reach the boundary of the space-time, which is this Cauchy horizon here, in a finite proper time. However, unlike Schwarzschild now, the tidal deformations for gamma remain finite. In particular, Kerr is smoothly extendable beyond this Cauchy horizon, and general relativity is still valid for gamma approaching the Cauchy horizon. So in that sense, the fate of gamma is completely undetermined. In particular, gamma doesn't, a priori, doesn't experience strong tidal deformations a priori, they can be as little as possible. So in that sense, kind of determinism severely fails for the explicit Kerr black hole, and it is geodesically incomplete, yet the reason for this incompleteness is not that general relativity breaks down. And that is, of course, a problem if you believe in determinism. And that also didn't appear for Newtonian gravity. Okay, with that in mind, kind of, I just like to say that for lambda positive and lambda negative, so for positive and negative cosmological constants, we have the completely analogous problems, and Kerr de Sitter and Kerr anti de Sitter are both smoothly extendable beyond their respective Cauchy horizons. So the same question of violation of determinism arises. And again, we always keep in mind that we think of the space-time as the unique solution arising from initial data. Okay, so now, however, Minkowski, Schwarzschild, and Kerr, they are, of course, highly symmetric solutions. And in that sense, kind of, they don't tell us anything a priori about what is the generic behavior. And that is what we're truly interested in, needless to say. And Penrose conjectured, well, generically, general relativity is deterministic. So in particular, kind of generically, the case of Kerr should not occur. And this led to the strong cosmic censorship conjecture. And I will now give the C0 formulation thereof, which is in some sense a strong formulation of this strongest formulation. Namely, that which says that for generic initial data for the Einstein equation, the arising solution is inextendable as a spacetime with continuous metric. So, kind of expressed a bit differently, this tells that generically, if the evolution is incomplete, then observers are torn apart by infinite tidal deformations, as in Schwarzschild. So generically, if the evolution is incomplete, then the reason is really that we leave the validity of the theorem, of the theory, as opposed to there's a lack of uniqueness, how it is in some sense the case in Kerr. So generically, in some sense, the behavior of Schwarzschild should be, generically, it should be more the behavior of Schwarzschild as opposed to Kerr. So that is, that's the hope. To believe in determinism. But now I already give you bad news, at least for the cases lambda equal to zero and lambda larger than zero. So the bad news is that conjecture one is false for lambda equal to zero and lambda positive. So it was proven that all solutions settling down to Kerr or Kerr de Sitter, they are continuously extendable beyond their Cauchy horizon. So the Cauchy horizon then survives perturbations. And moreover, the Cauchy horizon remains continuous and the solution is continuously extendable. And in that sense, conjecture one and the C0 formulation is false for lambda equal to zero and lambda positive. And here the key ingredient is that the exterior of the black hole is sufficiently stable in the sense that if you want gravitational perturbations on the exterior, that they decay at a sufficiently fast rate. And that rate is polynomial in the case of lambda equal to zero and even exponential in the case of lambda greater than zero. However, not all hope is lost. So there's a weaker formulation which has been studied in the history and kind of was particularly put forward by Chris Sudulo, which is still expected to be true. It doesn't give you, really the full idea that, that the observers are torn apart by tidal deformations, but in some sense it goes in this direction. And the hope is that this is true, but kind of a proof thereof is still lacking today. However, there's been a lot of literature, classical and also a lot of more recent one. In the case of lambda positive, however, as I already told you, the exterior is even more stable, so the decay of perturbations is exponential, which in particular is might even suggest that this weaker formulation put forward by Christodoulou may fail finally, or maybe not. And that's a very complicated story. And also on this topic, there has been lots of literature, some older literature, but also more recent literature and some more recent literature. And this still kind of remains or lacks a definitive answer. So while, of course, the problems lambda equal to zero and lambda positive have been studied a lot and are still very interesting, the case of lambda less than zero hasn't been studied almost at all. And that's what I'm going to talk about now. So the conjecture one for lambda less than zero, so the Z0 formulation of the strong cosmic censorship, has remained completely open up until now. I guess up until I started my PhD, maybe I should change that slide a little bit. So it turns out that the story actually for lambda less than zero is completely different compared to the cases I just told you. So first of all, I'd like to mention that the methods of proof in the cases lambda greater or equal to zero, so the methods of proof for a falsification of conjecture one, they manifestly fail. The reason is that asymptotically ADS spacetimes, black holes, are more unstable than asymptotically flat or de-Sitter black holes. And this kind of, in some sense, more instability in ADS black holes, this raises the attractive possibility, if you want, that conjecture one may be true after all for lambda equal, for lambda less than zero. And in that sense, determinism might even be in better shape for lambda less than zero. But actually, it turns out that even this problem, their connections to small divisors and to Diophantine approximation will arise. And I will talk about this later. And then related to this, also the resolution of this conjecture, which I will talk about in a second, will depend crucially on the notion of genericity. And that is also a phenomenon which didn't happen in the other cases, in lambda greater or equal to zero and lambda positive. So I hope now, and the following, I will now present a unexpected mixed resolution of the linear scalar analog of conjecture one. So I will not consider the full Einstein equation, but a scalar analog of conjecture one. So what is that scalar analog? Well, I call that scalar analog conjecture two. And to introduce it, I will just remind ourselves about the Gleiser-Nordström ADS black hole, and which is often referred as, so which is a solution of the Einstein-Maxwell system, and which is often referred to as a toy model for Kerr ADS because it is spherical symmetric and in that sense easier to analyze. And moreover, it has the same features as Kerr ADS, particularly the smooth Cauchy horizon. So on the right-hand side here, I have again depicted both a Reiser-Nordström and a Kerr ADS black hole in that as a Penrose diagram. And as you can see, both share the property that they have a smooth Cauchy horizon. So both explicit spacetimes violate determinism in that sense. which I kind of talked about before. To metric for recurrent, yes, I haven't written them explicitly, but you might very well know what it is. So now, instead of looking at the full nonlinear system, I look at linear perturbations, solving just this wave equation with the conformal mass here. So we're interested in what do solutions arising from smooth data, smooth generic data, let's say on a space-like hypersurface, so perturbations thereof, how do they behave as they approach the Cauchy horizon, which we want to test whether it's stable or not. So the linear scalar analog of that the Cauchy horizon is really C0 singular, or like continuously singular, is that generic linear scalar perturbations, so in some sense, if you have generic perturbations arising from data on sigma, that they blow up in amplitude. And here, that's kind of where, that's in some sense why it is the scalar analog of the continuous formulation. So these scalar perturbations that blow up in amplitude at the Cauchy horizon for both Reiser Nordstrom ADS or Kerr ADS black holes. So now the question is, well, does this conjecture two, which is the linear scalar analog of conjecture one, does it hold true? So is the Cauchy horizon, in some sense, C0 unstable for linear scalar perturbations? So the first theorem is on Reiser-Nordstrom, on the easy case. And while, of course, the exterior is more unstable, has more instabilities on the ADS case, a negative cosmological constant, I prove that, nevertheless, conjecture two is still false for Reiser-Nordstrom ADS. Okay, let me be more precise. More precisely, all linear scalar perturbations arising from data here, so again, solving this conformal wave equation, of Reiser-Nordstrom ADS remain uniformly bounded in the black hole interior. So they remain bounded, in particular also towards the Cauchy horizon. And moreover, they extend continuously across the Cauchy horizon. Oh. So in that sense, kind of conjecture two is false for Reiser-Nordstrom ADS. And so one might kind of give up and say, okay, maybe then our hope are not fulfilled finally, and the C0 formulation of strong cosmic censorship, the one we really like, because it corresponds to infinite tidal deformations, then it also doesn't hold for ADS black holes. And particularly one might have this in mind because the Reiser-Nordstrom ADS, or like Reiser-Nordstrom, is often referred to as a toy model for Kerr because of the kind of the same, because they have the same Penrose diagram. However, as it will turn out, for Kerr ADS, now the resolution of the previous conjecture crucially depends on the Diophantine properties of dimensionless mass and dimensionless angular momentum parameters. So these are just real numbers. And these Diophantine properties of these real numbers, they will kind of influence, or they will determine the resolution thereof.
Can I interrupt you for a second?
Of course.
So for, if you go to the previous slide, so if you go back to Reiser-Nordstrom ADS,
yeah.
So can you say a bit more about how the gradients of the scalar field behave?
Yeah, in some sense, the gradients, it's rather, okay, I don't want to say trivial, but it's because the exterior is more unstable, it's not so hard to show, and it also follows from my result that that you have like H1 blow up. That's what they blow up. Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
I'm sorry. So you're saying that the gradients blow up?
Right. Exactly.
But no more. So what did you say about the exterior?
The question of what happens at the Cauchy horizon is of course very intimately related to how stable is the exterior. And in ADS spacetimes, the exterior is only, which I will come to later also a bit, but I can already tell you here, is of course more unstable. So the decay on the exterior is only inverse logarithmic. And when analyzes this decay a bit further, and like one can prove is somehow not quite lower bounds, but one can use like the slow decay in order to show that in particular the gradient at the Cauchy horizon due to this slow decay will also blow up.
Okay, thank and you.
Okay, so so also because of the slow decay, one even might have hoped that that C kind of blows up at the Cauchy horizon, because this slow decay is manifestly too slow to kind of follow the old methods which were used to prove this bound. But I will talk about it in a second. And
Can I also ask a question?
Of course.
So in this first version of this cosmic censorship, right, so you mentioned about this infinite tidal field.
Right.
So if, let's say, if a metric is indeed continuous at the Cauchy horizon, but the derivative is not continuous,
yeah,
I think the tidal field is second order of the second order derivative of the metric. So
forces, right? I mean, the tidal forces are, okay, if you compute the Jacobi fields, they're of second order of the metric, but of course, to get the tidal deformation, you have to integrate twice. And okay, and in that sense, of course, the tidal deformations, which you're obviously interested in, they will be on the level of the metric themselves.
Oh, so you're not talking about the tidal
forces, which are, you're completely right, if you look at the Jacobi. That's right. But I'm like truly interested in the tidal deformations, which is the kind of thing you're interested in, because okay, you can have infinite tidal deformations, infinite tidal forces for an infinite small time, which won't kind of deform your object. So you really have to integrate twice, and that will be on the level of the metric.
So. Okay. Thanks.
So I guess I was here. So for Kerr ADS, the resolution depends again on the Diophantine properties of the mass and the dimensionless angular momentum. Okay. So now, let's first introduce kind of the Kerr ADS parameter space we're looking at. Namely, we look at all sub-extremal Kerr ADS parameters below the Hawking real bound, so we don't have issue of super radiance, because otherwise above it there's already super radiance, and the instability, the exterior is in some sense already unstable, and the growing modes exist. So we look at that kind of parameter range. And now the theorem is, which I have uploaded on the archive a couple of months ago, is that conjecture two, so which again we remind ourselves is the linear analog of the continuous formulation of the C0 formulation of strong cosmic censorship, holds true for bare generic Kerr ADS black holes. Okay, I will explain now what I mean by this. So more precisely, generic linear scalar perturbations. So again, we look at perturbations arising from a space like hypersurface of Kerr ADS blow up in amplitude. So blow up, like just see themselves at the Cauchy horizon for a set P blow up, which is a subset of capital P. So P blow up is just like some parameters from here. And this P blow up has the following properties. The first property is that P blow up is dense. So in particular, all over scattered in this capital P set, I can always find a number in this P blow up. Not only is this dense, it is also bare generic. So bare generic, for those who are not particularly familiar with it, this is a genericity condition from, in some sense, topology. So it arises from dissecting open sets. So in particular, for example, the rational numbers within all numbers are not generic. However, the irrational numbers are bare generic. So it is a typical notion of genericity one arising in topology. But they're bare generic. However, they're the Lebesgue exceptional. So the P blow-up is a Lebesgue null set. So if you look at the Lebesgue measure, or if you want probability or whatever, turns out that that while being bare generic, it's a Lebesgue null set. So just to remind ourselves, bare generic means countable intersection of open and dense sets. I guess just as a side note, but I guess it's not so clear how to imagine that. But anyway, it's a well-established notion of genericity arising from topology, whereas, of course, Lebesgue measure is this notion of genericity arising in measure theory or probability. So in that sense, kind of the linear analog of the strong cosmic censorship conjecture is respected for bare generic black holes. Now this theorem, which I told you, comes with the conjecture, which is still work in progress, namely that conjecture two, again, the strong cosmic censorship, is false for Lebesgue generic Caradius black holes. More precisely, all linear scalar perturbations remain bounded at the Cauchy horizon for a set which I call now p-bounded, and of course which has empty intersection with the p-blow-up, which I had introduced before, of dimensionless black hole parameters with the following properties. Again, p-bounded is dense. Again, but now p-bounded is Lebesgue generic, so it has full Lebesgue measure. However, of course, P bounded is bare exceptional because it's a complement. P blow up is bare generic. So, in that sense, the linear analog of the strong cosmic censorship is false for Lebesgue generic black holes. So, maybe I should, and we recall that, okay, conjecture two holds true for bare generic black holes. And this false ideas black holes. So, in some sense, in the Lebesgue generic case, we are in some sense in the case of Reissner-Nostrum ADS. So, but in the bare generic case, it holds true. I guess maybe this was a bit confusing, but so, are there any questions about the statement of the theorem?
Do you have example? Like for M and A, which M and A it is true and which one it is false?
It's a great question. Unfortunately, how I prove it, it doesn't give an example, unfortunately, yeah. I mean, the method of proof doesn't give an explicit example of, I guess if you want, let's say, if you think of Reissner-Nordström lying in the ADS, okay, lying in the bigger family of Kerr ADS, maybe even coupled to, okay, if you look at Kerr-Newman, the same should apply, first of all. So if you think of Reissner-Nordström lying in the big Kerr-Newman family, then of course the case A equal to zero would be an example where we are in the case which would lie in the p-bounded set. But a non-trivial example doesn't give this. Yeah. But that's, of course, an interesting problem. Okay. Good. Okay. Now, kind of to give you an idea how this arises, because I was also very surprised by this a priori, you might be very surprised how kind of this would pop up here. I will try to give you some heuristics why kind of Diophantine approximation and these competing notions of genericity arise. And I will just already say that the actual proof is intricate and technical. And here the heuristics I will use here, they actually do not play a role in the actual in the proof I give in the paper. But I think they give you a good idea why this should be related. Okay, so. We model the problem now just very easily. We have initial data, just let's say even compactly supported. And we separate the problem into two steps. The first step is to look at the exterior problem and then at the interior propagation. So the exterior problem, we just model, or like we kind of think that the solution is a sum of quasi-normal modes for the moment, which is not the case, because a generic solution cannot be written as a sum of quasi-normal modes, particularly in ADS spacetimes. But let's do this formula. Let's think of the solution as a sum of quasi-normal modes. And then we kind of take this quasi-normal modes and apply an interior scattering theory, if you want, from the event to the Cauchy horizon. And that is, since it's already based on the other work I did with Schlappendorf-Rothman, where we developed a scattering theory. And in that case, we do not develop one, but in some sense, for the heuristics, we think of having one. And then we will see what happens at the Cauchy horizon, and it will turn out that indeed the resolution of whether C blows up or not will depend on these diophantine properties of the black hole parameters. Okay, so now I already mentioned before that the exterior is in some sense more unstable as compared to asymptotically flat than this sidor black holes. So there's this theorem about Siegel-Smoot energy, which say that that solutions we just looked at, they only decay at an inverse logarithmic rate on the exterior, as opposed to polynomial and exponential in the for a cosmological constant greater or equal to zero. And this slow decay is intimately tied to a stable trapping phenomenon between the photosphere at infinity. And this slow decay can also captured or kind of manifests itself in the fact that there exists an infinite family of quasi-normal modes converging exponentially fast to the real axis. I will explain this in a second a bit more in details. And that all is related in some sense to the possible instability of ADS black holes, which is also a very interesting topic. But I won't discuss this any further here. Okay, so as I said already, exterior propagation we model with sum of quasi-normal modes, and of course we want to invoke finite energy. So these quasi-normal modes are finite energy solutions which are kind of have the separated form. But now the point is that this oscillatory factor, the frequency of this oscillatory factor, it has both a real part and an imaginary part. And for high angular momenta, so for high L, that's the angular momentum parameter, the real part oscillates linearly, and the imaginary part, which will give you the rate of decay, will convert exponentially fast in L to zero. So the higher L's you take, the higher angular momenta or like angular parameters you take, the slower your quasi-normal mode will. And now if you take an infinite sum of them, and okay, you also impose finite energy or arising from smooth initial data, then you will see that this will lead to this 1/log result, which I've already kind of stated before. So in particular, slowly decaying quasi-normal modes, they are associated to high frequencies, L and omega, particular, the real part of omega is large. So now we take an infinite sum of such quasi-normal modes. And we have to sum them correctly in order to get we have to sum them with obviously some weights. And in order to have finite energy, these weights have to decay exponentially. That's a proposition that I will not now explain further, but these weights have to decay exponentially. Otherwise, there won't be finite energy. Okay, so now we take this ansatz and on the event horizon. Okay, so weights times, okay, this is a constant, this is spherical harmonics, and it's a bit more generalized on Curie ADS, but and then here is the oscillatory part, and here is the decaying part. Okay, now kind of having studied the exterior problem, let's go to the interior one. Okay, so for the interior problem, I have to tell you story of the interior problem. So the analog of a scattering operator in the interior problem is a multiplication with a reflection coefficient on the Fourier side. So particularly, so the scattering problem and the interior is more, you take the Fourier side on the event horizon, you multiply it by, let's say, reflection coefficient to come here, and then you take the inverse Fourier transform again, and then you morally get the behavior of C at the Cauchy horizon. However, kind of this reflection coefficient has a pole at the zero frequency with respect to the generator of the Cauchy horizon. That is also one of the kind of insights of our paper, of my paper with Yakov, Schlappendorf-Rothman. So let's remind ourselves, what is the generator of the Cauchy horizon in Reisen-Nordström? This is just d by dt. So the scattering operator in Reisen-Nordström ADS will have a pole at omega equals zero. So R will be something like one over omega. On Kerr ADS, however, the generator of the Cauchy horizon is T plus omega minus, which is just a constant, which is in some sense to eigenrotation of the Cauchy horizon, times phi. D by the phi is just the, so phi is, capital phi is just D by the phi, so the rotation of the sphere. Just close this. Good. So they're still doing works here at ETH at the time. Okay, good. So, so now let's talk about Reisen-Nordström ADS first. As I already said, the reflection coefficient has a pole at omega equals zero, and then, okay, there's something analytic inbounded. Let's not care about this. I also mentioned that in order to understand the scattering problem, we take the Fourier transform of the event horizon, multiply it with the reflection coefficient, and then again take the inverse Fourier transform to get the behavior at the Cauchy horizon. So the Fourier transform on the event horizon, okay, these weights just sum up, and then, okay, let's say formally we get a delta function at at the real part, and then also the imaginary part. And then we sum, because we have the sum of all of those. That's just a formal computation, but let's keep going. Then, taking the Fourier transform, so to get the behavior on the Cauchy horizon, we take the Fourier transform on the event horizon, multiply by R, and then take the inverse Fourier transform again. Expanding that out, we have sum over ML, these coefficients AML, and then there will be this term, which has this 1 over omega coming from the reflection coefficient times this delta function at the quaternary mode frequencies. Then we integrate over the omega, and okay, YML, let's forget about this. Then, kind of evaluating again formally this integral will give you again this AML, and then of course there will be a denominator. Namely that this delta function, of course, or like this minus here, goes into here this 1 over omega. So it reads 1 over C times L times this exponential decay. And that is totally fine, because in some sense, we only have to take care about a large L in this formal computation. And so the denominator is very, okay, it's bounded by 1, or like it's bounded below. So particularly this is bounded, and AML converge exponentially fast. So this tells me that the quasi-normal modes, which are high frequency, they decouple from the low frequency scattering pole, because omega equals zero, the problematic frequency in the interior, okay, that's at low frequency, and the quasi-normal modes are high frequency. So this couples, this decouples, both problems decouple, and that's why we have finally boundedness at the Cauchy horizon on Reisen-Nordström ADS. And that is the key ingredient, maybe. However, now, we come to the case of Kerr ADS. And now it gets more interesting. For Kerr ADS, the reflection coefficient has a pole at omega minus times M. Because again, that is the zero frequency of the killing generator of the Cauchy horizon. We again forget about this and the rest here. Yeah, okay, we can control this. Doing the same computation as again, C at the Cauchy horizon is Fourier transform R, inverse Fourier transform times these weights. Okay, it's sketchy now. Then we have a sum over AML, these weights, and then again, principal value of the reflection coefficients times this delta function. And now the point is, of course, that we have to replace this into here. So we obtain the sum AML, the coefficient state, and then we have a different denominator, namely omega minus minus CL minus I minus this exponentially decaying factor. Now, however, kind of for M, okay, yeah, for M large and L also large, this becomes small, this becomes exponentially small, and this can a priori be also be small if there's cancellation. So in particular, the quasi-normal modes which are high frequency, in principle, couple to the zero frequency poles, because frequency zero frequency poles in the interior are not zero frequency outside. Because while, of course, omega minus is zero frequency interior, in the interior or at the Cauchy horizon, omega can be big and M can be big while this difference is small. So this says that on Kerr ADS, due to the rotation finally, because only in that case omega minus is non-zero, quasi-normal modes in the exterior coupled to the zero frequency poles in the interior. Okay. So this quantity now formally, okay, this very formal computation, blows up if this, okay, let's forget about this very, this also decays exponentially. So in particular, we want this to decay exponentially. So if this difference decays, goes to zero as M and L go to infinity faster than AML, then this quantity blows up. But I actually only need it for one sequence. So if there exists infinitely many ML, such that this difference goes to zero faster than AML, faster than exponential, then there's flow. And this lies at the heart of Diophantine approximation. Let's be a bit more precise. So recall AML goes to zero exponentially, and we get a blow up if this difference also goes to zero exponentially for infinitely many ML. But now, of course, omega minus is purely a function of the black hole parameters, and so is this constant C. So now, the in some sense, the resonant or like the blow up set will be the set of omega minus divided by this constant here, such that omega minus divided by C minus L divided by M is exponentially small for infinitely many ML. Okay, so let's recall again that L and M are of course integers. So you really ask the question whether a real number can be approximated by a rational number, because L and M in some sense represent all rational numbers. Okay, let's say positive rational or yeah. Whether a real number, namely this kind of this omega minus divided by C, can be approximated by a rational number at a in some sense fast speed. And this question is exactly the question one asks in Diophantine approximation. So it turns out that this set R, which I've written down here, that actually has a name. These are the so-called exponential Liouville numbers in number theory. And they have the property that they are bare generic, but they're Lebesgue exceptional. Just as was the case in the other, in my theorem, which I say. So the blow up, so the P blow up, and the P blow up in the theorem I stated is of course not as explicit or as easy as I've written it here, unfortunately, but it is what it is. But it has a similar kind of Diophantine approximation type structure. And it also has the same properties of being bare generic and the Lebesgue exceptional. So kind of with this heuristics, I guess it's a bit clearer now why blow up or boundedness of Psi crucially depends on the Diophantine properties of A and of these dimensionless black hole parameters MA. Again, this is of course a dimensionless quantity, I should have maybe said already. Yeah, are there questions so far about this? Almost finished.
Okay, so you've been talking about the Diophantine approximation.
Yep.
Throughout the talk, but I've never heard of this. So can you explain what it is?
Well, okay, yeah, of course. So the Diophantine approximation one asks the question whether how well can a real number be approximated by rational numbers? That's essentially the question one asks. And
Right. So, but is there a requirement of being, you know, an approximation to, I mean, how good an approximation does it have to be? I mean, that's your criterion one, right?
Right. So, and of course, there are different like types of approximation, what you just said. So here, actually, I have, in some sense, a very fast approximation, namely exponential in the denominator or numerator of the rational numbers. Okay, let me maybe I can. Okay, no, unfortunately, this doesn't look so. Okay, no. So of course, one can also ask the question about this. Okay. This set of real numbers, let's say, that can be approximated with a rate, let's say, q to the r, for example. I mean, and now the question is, okay, what's the, I mean, typical question in number theory would be, maybe I say for infinitely many pq, right? And pq, of course, are, let's say, integers. So these are typical questions. And then what's the Lebesgue measure of that set? Well, is the set bare generic? Is it, what's even the Hausdorff measure of that set? And it turns out that, the same questions of Diophantine approximation kind of also happen to appear in this problem. And okay, a priori, I was not aware, but it turns out that I hopefully explained why this is the case. Let me finish really quickly the talk and I'm happy to discuss this further because I already said that one can study further properties of this set, which I already told you. Namely, for example, one can look at the fractal dimensions of this set. And okay, it turns out that this set has full packing dimension. So packing dimension is something similar like Hausdorff dimension, but it has only logarithmic Hausdorff dimension. So okay, one can ask all these kind of questions, and now it becomes very much in some sense related, like more in the style of Diophantine approximation questions one asks. So we prove actually that this set I construct has full packing dimension, but it's kind of still an open problem, whether that set has, what's the Hausdorff dimension of it. But yeah, I assume that it's 1 plus log because of this exponential decay. But so there has been techniques in some sense which are very robust to prove these kind of things developed in the last years. And well, it would be interesting to see whether they can still apply in the current setting. I guess this comes to the end of my talk. So just to quickly summarize, conjecture two was the linear scalar analog of the C0 formulation of strong cosmic censorship. And I've first proven that it's false for Eisen-Ostrom, and it's true or false, namely depending on the Diophantine properties and the notion of genericity imposed for Kerr radius. And this is also related to incidents similar to KM theory. And thank you very much for your attention. And I'm happy to answer, of course, and further discuss anything. Thanks.
Thank you, Christoph, for a great talk. We already had quite a number of questions. Do we have any more questions for Christoph?
I do too, after one is done.
Okay.
thank you for the beautiful talk. So I have another question. Mm-hmm. So your argument, right? So it's based on, so you first inject external quasi-normal as external data to the interior and then study how this data evolve at the Cauchy horizon. So what if you try to imagine another scenario, right? Like for example, you send a bomb through this horizon and this bomb just explode in the interior. So, right, like it's not necessarily a summation of the exterior quasi-normal, but instead this bomb explode in the interior, so it excites all the interior quasi-normal. So maybe in that case, then you will face this pole, I mean, omega 2 equals 0 pole directly. You don't I mean,
what I actually do, I don't use quantum remotes. Maybe I should maybe say that more. The reason is exactly, or like it's related to what you said, namely that quantum remotes don't represent a generic solution of the wave equation, let's say. Particular generic solution cannot be written as a sum of quantum remotes. That is why actually I choose just like initial data on just like arbitrary initial data, or like I choose generic initial data on a space like hypersurface sigma. And okay, there is some genericity condition also on the initial data, and that is of course related to this fact that in the fully nonlinear theory, you only need genericity for the initial data. If you ever perturb the black hole, then both you have genericity on the background itself and genericity on the data. So now, of course, my talk was focused, or like I explained explicitly, kind of, which is the surprising part, in my opinion, the genericity of the black hole background. But of course, there's also genericity of the initial data, because let's say, for example, if you start with zero initial data, then this will obviously not give a blow up. However, I also proved that in the case of blow up, okay, really, truly, there's like explicit genericity condition, which I can write down, which is generic and which will lead to blow up at the Cauchy horizon. And in that sense, I do not take a sum of quantum remotes.
Okay, thanks.
To look at the horizon Cauchy. Yeah, I guess. But thanks for your question.
Yes, I'm still trying to get some intuition about the structure of P blow up. So would it be possible to do something like this? So you have a two-parameter, you have a two-dimensional parameter space, right? So you have M and A, and you can represent this as a nice little box in, you know, on a piece of paper. And there's a boundary because you want to say sub-extremal. But anyway, so that's your two-dimensional space. Is it possible to scan through that space and color map the points that are, members of P blow up, and see what kind of structure you get for the color coded points?
That would be super interesting. Like, I can already tell you that first of all, it's going to be in some sense, there's first of all, like, it's going to be translation invariant. I guess you can see my drawings, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. It's not be the case that, let's say, this part, of course, is P blow up and this part is P bounded, let's say. That will definitely not be the case. First of all, already, because both sets are dense, right? So it will, however, be the case that the P bounded, which I guess I can write like red, and then let's even use these colors, and then there's P blow up, which I write like blue. They will all be all scattered in that set. I mean, they will all be dense, and we have this competing notion of genericity. And I guess the things one looks at there is exactly the question of Hausdorff measure, packing dimension, these kind of things one typically looks to visualize it. It's very difficult. Like, how do you, for example, visualize even the rational numbers within the real numbers? I mean, it's, particularly a dense set, it's hard to visualize. But I think it's also interesting. I'm afraid I can't give you a more visual answer to that question.
Yeah, but do you think it's possible to produce a map like this? I mean, obviously you would have to introduce some binning structure, and maybe the binning structure would have to be incredibly fine to do justice to the sets. But it would be nice to have a picture of what's going on, and, you know, just a visual impression.
I mean, there's also some self-similarity structure that, okay, if you go finer and finer, maybe there, okay, that will be interesting. Okay, I haven't looked at it further, but of course it will cost, it will be interesting to look at it. I'm afraid I haven't looked at it so much, but yeah, I will do so in the future.
No, thanks.
Okay, and Will has a question.
Thanks for the talk. So given the fact that, I mean, you're telling us basically that for Caradius, like, you know, given one solution that's where you have blow up on the horizon, there's another solution that's like infinitely close to it where you don't have it. I mean, do you have a sense for sort of which one is the more physical one? Like, for example, if now you started including like the back reaction of the scalar field on the metric? Like, do you have a sense of which way it's going to go?
First of all, that's an absolutely great question, and in my opinion, one of the most interesting things, in, at least what I know. one might, of course, think that, okay, the instability, okay, if you compare instability against stability, that somehow instability wins, although it might be, it might not happen, but in some sense, if you dynamically move A and M, then you will always hit these, like, say, points where A and M will be unstable. And in that sense, one might conjecture that that in some sense, instability wins at some point. I mean, it's similar kind of related topic arises in, let's say, in just like classical dynamical systems where, one has these resonances occurring, and whether these resonances give rise to instabilities or not also is highly dependent on Diophantine properties or of parameters involved in the dynamical system. And I just imagine, like, very heuristically that in some sense one would see more unstable features of this kind of linear result. But it's highly open, and yeah, it would be very interesting to address that further.
Thanks.
Okay, any final questions?
Well, so Christopher, I have a request. Sorry, I joined in late. Can I have a copy of your slides? Maybe I can question later.
Of course.
This is Luis Lehner, by the way. Thanks.
I saw. Okay, of course, yeah.
Yeah, that was a great talk. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, yeah. Any other final questions? If not, then let's thank Christoph again for the beautiful talk, and see you all next week. Thanks.